August 11th, 2009, was a hot and humid day in the North Georgia town of Blairsville. 38-year-old Christy Cornwell was visiting with her parents that summer as she'd recently embarked on major changes in her life. She'd left her career as a probation officer and was pursuing a new journey into the medical field. She had gotten divorced a few months earlier, but in recent times, had begun dating a man with whom she hoped she might develop a future. Due to a lower back injury sustained during a fall, Christy had taken to late evening walks. They eased her pain, and in the evening, the hot and sticky weather wasn't nearly as intense. Her mother didn't like her walking so late, but Christy assured her that she could take care of herself, and besides, they were in Blairsville, a picturesque southern town with less than 1,000 residents. They'd lived there all their lives, and Christy, if nothing else, always felt safe at home. That night, with her phone in her pocket and an earbud in, she spoke to her new boyfriend, Douglas, as she walked the streets of her hometown. Then, suddenly and without warning, Douglas heard a commotion and distinctly heard Christy cry out, "Don't take me." An instant later, the phone emitted only the sound of static as Douglas screamed her name but received no answer. In the days, weeks, and years that followed, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation would cover hundreds of acres of land in a desperate search. They will uncover connections to other instances of abduction and other attempts in the area. These clues will lead them on a multi-state search for a light-colored SUV and a suspect described by previous would-be victims. For investigators, it's a race against the clock that will ultimately end in tragedy, and the monster, who many believe committed this crime, will cowardly spare himself the requirement to face justice and to answer for his acts when he takes his own life during a 3-hour standoff with Atlanta police. Yet still, questions remain, and though authorities believe they've found their man, they can't prove it. Even after Christy's remains are discovered by her own brother, just miles from the site of her abduction. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 44, The Abduction and Murder of Christy Cornwell. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. In today's episode, I examine the tragic story of the abduction and murder of Christy Cornwell. Before getting into the case, I want to ask you to stick around at the end of today's episode. I have several announcements to make regarding the one-year anniversary of Trace Evidence. 3 weeks from today, on May 22nd, a contest in which you have the chance to win some awesome prizes, including Studio Regent headphones, a Trace Evidence t-shirt, and even the chance to record an outro to a future episode. I will also discuss my appearance on an upcoming podcast, a large podcast meetup to take place in Atlanta this fall, your ability to participate in the one-year anniversary episode, and my plans for CrimeCon, which I'll be attending this week. So stick around for all of that information after the episode, and now, a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and missing persons. Trace Evidence is available across all platforms and can be found on iTunes, Google Play Music, iHeartRadio, SoundCloud, YouTube, and many more. Further information, including full episodes, transcripts, merchandise, social media links, YouTube videos, and much more, can be found on the website at trace-evidence.com. Trace Evidence has a Patreon for those of you who wish to support the podcast. Patrons receive shoutouts, stickers, ad-free episodes, and special updates. This podcast is a complete one-man operation, so if you wish to help, please check out the Patreon page at patreon.com/traceevidence. Donations can also be made via PayPal for those of you who wish to help but don't want to use Patreon. There is a PayPal donation button on the website. If you'd like to contact me, you can email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Find me on Twitter at traceevpod. That's TRACEEVPOD. Add me on Instagram at traceevidencepod, or join the Trace Evidence discussion group on Facebook simply by searching for Trace Evidence or clicking the direct link on the website. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, I'd love to hear from you. As a final note, if you enjoy the show, please rate and review it on whatever app or platform you're listening on. The more ratings and reviews the show gets, the easier it becomes to find the podcast, and the more attention can be given to the cases that I cover. Today, I examine the abduction and murder of 38-year-old Christy Cornwell. It's a terribly heart-wrenching story of loss and suspicion. This is the one case I've covered for which the answers are almost completely known, though they cannot be proven. It's a little different, but it's a story I felt compelled to share. This is episode 44, The Abduction and Murder of Christy Cornwell. Christy Lee Cornwell was born on December 20th, 1970, in Hiawassee, Georgia, to parents Joanne and Harold. Christy was the Cornwell's firstborn child, and her younger brother, Richard, would be born later. Though born in Hiawassee, Christy would spend her life being raised in the rural town of Blairsville, Georgia, living on two separate family-owned farms throughout her childhood. Blairsville is the county seat of Union County, which sits on the border between Georgia and North Carolina. Blairsville is indicative of the term rural, with a total population sitting at just over 650 residents. A very small town, Blairsville sits on 1.1 square miles of land and endures a humid, subtropical climate. However, being that the town sits at an elevation of 1,883 feet, it often experiences the benefits of cool nights, as opposed to much of the rest of southeastern United States, making the days warm and sticky, while the nights may be brisk and refreshing. Christy's family was just what you'd imagine in small-town USA. Joanne worked as a teacher, while Harold tended farms and was an experienced and skilled outdoorsman. From a young age, Christy's independence and focus were clearly evident, and she didn't have a problem expressing herself or standing up for what she believed in. Friends and family have often described her as the type of person who had a soft spot in her heart for those who were less fortunate, and she had a strong adherence to justice resonating from her soul. This passion for doing what is right and defending those who couldn't help themselves would stick with her throughout her life. Christy was an adept student, focused and determined to do the best she could, but this didn't suppress the strong-willed, wildly humorous young woman who lurked beneath the surface. When Richard was born, Christy was head over heels for her new little brother. The excitement and joy she'd provided to the rest of her family was now expanded to include her new sibling, but like most brother and sister relationships, they had their share of battles, though the question of love and protection was never up for debate. While Christy may have given Richard a hard time, and he would often repay the favor, it was obvious to everyone they knew that each would step in and protect the other from any attacks from someone outside of the family. They developed a strong bond, based around humor and endless support. When asked about his sister later, Richard stated, quote, "We loved to joke around with each other. We had our share of disputes when we were children, but as we became adults, those never happened. End quote. Growing up in a rural area is quite different from an urban environment, and while they may not have had the benefits of a big town with a lot of hustle and bustle, they did have the excitement of the wilderness. Christy enjoyed playing outside, and was, for much of her life, a tomboy of sorts, though the older she got, the more her feminine prowess would develop, and her beauty would become difficult to ignore for all the small-town boys who passed her by. Growing up on a farm can be hard work, but it does come with its benefits. Richard later said, quote, "We grew up on two different farms, and we both loved to ride horses and loved the outdoors," end quote. In Blairsville, the siblings would get their fair share of fun in the sun, often playing until dusk when they'd rush home for dinner with their family. Harold and Joanne raised their children to be polite, kind, and respectful, with a strong foundation of love and faith. Religion played a strong role in their lives, as is often the case in rural areas, especially along the Bible Belt. Throughout her life, Christy would become a member of the Crossover Community Church, located in Blue Ridge, Georgia. She was often active on missions at her church, believing that spreading the gospel and sharing her faith were important qualities of a good individual. This, supported by her family's faith and strength, gave Christy a resilient spirit and determined mindset where she believed that she could do anything. Even from a young age, Christy's focus was on helping others, and she did her best to bring light and happiness into the lives of everyone she cared about. Friends have commented how Christy would often lend her ear to strangers, and she has been defined as having a gentle soul and a giving generosity. Details about Christy's past are scarce, and while her younger years are submerged in the shadows of the unknown, some information does rise to the surface. Christy graduated in 1989 from Union County High School and would go on to pursue a career in law enforcement, eventually working as a probation officer. While she had a deep passion for law enforcement and enjoyed working her career, there was always the subtle suggestion that she wanted to take a more hands-on approach to saving others. While working in probation could be rewarding, there was something about wanting to be there for someone before things went wrong, before the legal system got involved, that spoke to her. Christy was a strong woman who did enjoy using her position to teach others while continuing to expand her own abilities. She had taken martial arts and began instructing self-defense courses for others. She thoroughly enjoyed working with firearms and was a proficient shot, taking many classes and practicing frequently. A skilled shot and a woman capable of defending herself, she enjoyed her free time riding her motorcycle and exploring the beauty of the world around her. She had an intense passion for nature and took tremendous pleasure in hiking, walking, and simply being surrounded by the pastures and wooded areas of Georgia. Christy's love life was troubled, to say the least. She would eventually get married and divorced a total of 3 times. The last marriage had barely lasted for 2 months when everything came undone. While she was a deeply loving woman, her past experiences had given her a sense of hesitance when it came to new relationships. Her strong will and independence could be challenging for a man, and while many expected her to acquiesce to their desires, she had a mind of her own and wasn't shy about expressing it. With a heart so big, it isn't uncommon for it to be broken, and Christy certainly experienced her share of emotional pain, but she always managed to find her way through. Her greatest gift in life, she believed, was her son, Brody. Christy was a good mother, doting on her son at every turn. She raised him just as she had been raised, with love, faith, and respect. She loved every moment that she had with him, and others couldn't help but be drawn into what has frequently been described as an incredible level of devotion. Christie's mother, Joanne, would later say, quote, "She loved her son more than anything. I mean, he was the joy of her life. She was a wonderful mother," end quote. Richard was an uncle to Brody, but his career had drawn him out of the rural area, settling in Knoxville, Tennessee, a few hours' drive away. Despite the distance, the Cornwell family remained close, bonded by their love and care. Throughout Christie's marital struggles, she never felt alone, for she knew that everyone would be there at the drop of a hat if she needed them, just as she would do the same for them. Christie's third marriage ended in the late spring of 2009, and while she was reeling, she never quite gave up hope that there was someone out there for her. Brody was now a teenager, and she found comfort in watching her little boy grow into a man. Regardless of her love life, Brody would always be the one who truly owned his mother's heart, and that was something which drove her forward and gave her the energy and determination to follow her dreams and to pursue all that she desired. Christie would ultimately make the decision to leave her career as a probation officer, listening to that little voice that had always guided her to do more. She enrolled in Dalton State College, located in Dalton, Georgia, just an hour and a half drive west of Blairsville. While working a part-time job at Home Depot years earlier, Christie met Melissa Camp, who would become her best friend. The two had grown up with similar backgrounds in small towns and almost immediately hit it off. Melissa would later say, quote, "We considered each other best friends, and she was the sister I never had," end quote. When Christie returned to school, Melissa was very excited because she knew Christie had always wanted to do more. Christie was in school now to be a medical technician, a field in which she might be able to continue her love of helping others, but perhaps in a way which was very different from probation, and yet also similar. She would still be working to improve lives and save others, but now it would be in the field of medicine. In the summer of 2009, Christie was a 38-year-old single mother working towards a new degree and focused on setting out a new path in her life. She was excited by the prospects that lied on her horizon, but there was still one area of her life that was lacking presence, and that was her love life. Though nervous and feeling scarred by incidents in her past, Christie decided to try her hand at least one more time. She signed up on an online dating website and in her free time would look through various profiles and answer messages from potential suitors. In June of 2009, she made contact with a man who seemed to provide much of what she'd been looking for. Douglas Davis was a pastor living in Atlanta. He was kind, caring, and devoted to God. According to Melissa, the relationship was moving slowly, but Christie felt there was a real connection there. While she was worried, that ever-present anxiety of waiting for the other shoe to drop, she was very open with Douglas about her past, and to her surprise, it didn't frighten him away. When asked later about their relationship, Douglas responded, quote, "Our relationship was just about us, and we were looking forward to a future together," end quote. Their courtship was sweet and old school, in a sense, which Christie deeply appreciated. She couldn't help but wonder if mistakes from the past had been the result of rushing forward, following those initial feelings of love and infatuation, without giving them time to truly incubate. While Douglas had tremendous feelings for Christie, they were still new, and he was in no rush either. Douglas would later say that he truly believed that God had brought them together, and Christie's mother commented that this was as if all of her prayers had finally been answered, and they thought that he could be the one. Christy looked at her relationship with Douglas as the opportunity to start anew, to refresh, and to make up for lost time in past relationships. They spent their free time together, talking in depth about everything from their dreams and aspirations to their faith and their flaws. Christy was going to be spending the summer that year at her parents' home in Blairsville, while Douglas remained in Atlanta, though they made plans to visit each other. In the weeks leading up to this vacation, Christy suffered an accident. After a day of strong rain, she slipped down some slick stairs and took a nasty fall. This fall resulted in damage to her tailbone, and the result was Christy experiencing a constant state of discomfort. The throbbing ache was always there, but Christy soon learned that walking seemed to ease the pressure. She began going out for evening walks and would return home feeling better and with the pain lessened. Joanne was concerned about the walks, asking Christy why she couldn't just take the walks during the daytime. According to Joanne, she had mentioned to Christy that she was worried because, if something happened, she wouldn't even know where to begin looking. Christy shared her route with her mom and told her not to worry. She also explained that, with the days being as hot as they were, it was much more comfortable for her to take the walks at dusk. Blairsville wasn't the kind of place where bad things happened, and Joanne would later say, quote, "Most people know each other and go to church together, and you know, it's just, you feel safe here. A lot of people don't even lock their doors," end quote. Besides, were something to ever go wrong, Christy always had her cell phone with her. She would often walk with an earpiece in, putting her phone in her pocket and just chatting away. Sometimes she spoke to Melissa, other times it was Douglas. Either way, Christy felt secure having it with her, and she had training in self-defense and had been a probation officer. Christy never doubted her ability to take care of herself. All of that would change on the night of Tuesday, August 11th, 2009. It had been a normal day, and Christy had spent it at home with Joanne and Harold. As the sun began to set, she changed her clothes and gathered up her cell phone and earpiece. She told her mother she was going out for her evening walk and slowly stepped outside. Joanne had gotten used to it by now, and it was just another part of Christy's routine. She had no way of knowing that this would be the last time she'd ever see her daughter. Joanne would later recall, quote, "She said, 'I'm going for my walk now,' and I didn't even look up from the newspaper. I said, 'Okay,'" end quote. Christy's path would carry her down Jones Creek Road, where she would pass a picturesque little church that she'd grown a fondness for. On this particular night, she dialed up Douglas, and the two began chatting as she walked along. The conversation seemed fairly innocuous and along the lines of their normal talk. It was after 9 p.m., and while Christy was fully confident in her abilities to take care of herself, the walks were often made more comfortable and they felt quicker if she was having a conversation on the phone. After getting Douglas on the call, she slid her phone down into her pocket, using her earpiece to remain hands-free. Christy made a comment to Douglas to hang on. She had to move out of the way of a vehicle that was coming down the road. It seemed like a minor detail until moments later, when Douglas would become an audio witness to her abduction. According to Douglas, he heard Christy scream, and she said something along the lines of, "Please, don't take me." Douglas immediately sat up in a panic. He called out her name, asked her what was going on, but Christy couldn't answer him. He could hear the sounds of a struggle, and Christy seemed to be pleading with someone. Among the things he heard Christy saying was that she was being tied up, that she had a son, that she had lived in the area all her life, and that she didn't want to be hurt. Douglas didn't know what to do, He just continued to call her name, but the other end of the phone was static. Douglas would later say, quote, "I know her voice, and I know it well. She was afraid, and the tone of it gave me the fullest confidence that she was being abducted." End quote. The call was still connected, but there were no voices. There was nothing. Completely freaking out, Douglas immediately picked up his landline phone and dialed 911. Unfortunately, Douglas was in Atlanta, just over 100 miles south of Blairsville. His call to 911 landed him on the Atlanta Police Department's dispatch, and when he explained the situation, they explained that he needed to speak with someone in Union County. Douglas was given a number to call, apparently a non-emergency number, which led to the Union County Sheriff's Department. He called multiple times, but received no answer. Frustrated and not sure what else he could do, Douglas continued trying to reach someone in law enforcement, but couldn't connect with anyone in the area, and so, in desperation, he dialed 411 for information and got the home number of Christie's parents. He called and found Joanne on the other end. Joanne would later say, quote, "About approximately 9:25 p.m., the phone rang, so I picked it up." Douglas said, "Joanne, listen, I was on the phone with Christie and someone's taken her." I said, "What are you saying?" He said, "Someone is taking her. Someone has kidnapped her." He heard her screaming and heard her say, "Please don't take me." End quote. Sometime between Christie's initial abduction, Douglas finally reaching Joanne, and Joanne dialing 911 and being connected to the Union County Sheriff's Department, 40 to 45 minutes pass. The time of Christie's abduction has been officially listed as occurring between 9:15 and 9:20 p.m., but the call to the sheriff's dispatch isn't received until 10 p.m. Due to jurisdictional issues, being given the runaround, and a non-emergency phone number, precious time has been lost, and in those lost minutes, Christie could be as far as 40 to 50 miles away by this time. Almost immediately after placing the call, Joanne goes out in her car and begins driving around the area she knows Christie walks. Christie's father, Harold, also goes searching for his daughter. Douglas is already in his car and is driving north to Blairsville. Christie's brother, Richard, has begun the drive from Knoxville, and even Christie's best friend, Melissa, is heading towards the family home. The Union County Sheriff's Department arrives on the scene, setting up a command post at the church that Christie always walked past. They begin combing the road, looking for any sign that Christie could still be in the area. They find nothing which indicates a struggle, and they're unable to locate anything which points them in what direction the abductor may have gone. Being that it's late at night, this makes the searching more difficult. That rural area is not well lit, and so officers are shining spotlights from their cruisers as others comb over areas with flashlights. It's a frustrating prospect. Aside from the darkness, they don't have a pinpoint location to begin at. All that is known is the route that Christie typically took, the amount of time that passed from when she left her parents' home and the abduction occurred, and so they have to estimate an approximate location, even though they will cover all areas along her route. Richard arrived at the family home by 1 a.m. He had driven hard and fast, rushing to the aid of his sister and to be there for his parents. When he pulled up, he finds that Douglas and Melissa have arrived prior to him, and he heads inside. Melissa is an absolute wreck, not knowing what to think or what can be done to help. She rushes to Douglas and asks the pastor if he might lead a prayer for them in hopes of settling their nerves as well as giving them the strength and hope they so desperately need. Melissa recalls her last conversation with Christie, a phone call several hours before the abduction, and the call she received from Joanne. Melissa later states, quote, She was really so full of life and joy, and her mom called me that night, hearing that something may be wrong. I had no idea that it could be this. End quote. When Douglas is later asked about Christy, he says, quote, "In my heart, she's a fighter. She had faith in the Lord, and that's real. And I believe that faith will sustain her." End quote. After speaking with the family and telling them everything he knows, Douglas is directed to the church command post to see if he can help investigators. When Douglas gets to the church, he finds that, in addition to the Union County Sheriff's Department, there are officers from the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, or GBI. They were in the county working on an unrelated homicide investigation, and when they learned of the abduction, they decided to join in and assist. Douglas is immediately questioned, multiple times, to give them every piece of information he has. They ask him first about the phone call. What specifically did Christy say? Could he hear the suspect at all? Did she describe him, the vehicle, her location, or any other details that may be of assistance? GBI Special Agent Brian Whidbey states that Douglas, quote, said that she normally walked with an earbud in her ear so she didn't have to hold her telephone. Approximately 9:20 p.m. is when she made her statement, "Hang on, I have to get out of the way of this vehicle." He hears what he described as a commotion, and then he hears Christy scream. Just a few seconds after that, she makes statements to the effect that she was tied up, "Please don't hurt me, she has a son, and she's lived in the area all her life." We believe that Christy was actually talking to her abductor, trying to reason with this person, and also to let Douglas, her boyfriend, know that things were happening to her that she couldn't control. End quote. While authorities take notes on his story, and others are on the streets searching for Christy, they also go through the process of verifying Douglas's story. As a new boyfriend, and someone who appears to have been on the phone with her during the abduction, they have to consider him a possible suspect. They begin trying to verify his location when Christy disappeared. They pull phone records to confirm the call, and they search their systems to see if Douglas has any kind of record or history that might make him more suspicious. Ultimately, though, Douglas comes back as clean, and they're able to verify that he was in fact in Atlanta when the abduction took place. The last time Douglas saw Christy was days earlier when they had lunch in Atlanta. Agent Whidbey says, quote, "He was not in the area of Christy's abduction. He has been ruled out as any type of suspect." End quote. After discussing the phone call, their next thought process is that Christy may have been taken by someone she knew or had known. They ask Douglas thorough questions regarding her past, if she'd recently been afraid of anyone, or made statements about someone who had threatened her. They're looking for anything they can find, and they let Douglas know that what may not seem like an important detail at the time could prove very important later. Douglas explains that he knew a lot about Christy's past, but that there was nothing she'd ever said to him to make him think she could be in danger. In an interview, Douglas later says, quote, "I have no idea. In all of our conversations, the many hours we've talked and shared our lives, she never indicated that there's anyone in her past who could do such a thing." End quote. Outside of Douglas, authorities have to consider many other possibilities, including Christy's previous husbands. They begin conducting a thorough investigation to check into their backgrounds, as well as trying to confirm their locations in the hours leading up to and following Christy's disappearance. While not much is revealed about this aspect of the investigation, the three men are ultimately ruled out when they have solid alibis. Set back to square one, investigators begin to consider the possibility that this could be random, but they have another massive list of potential suspects to look at. Due to Christy's former job as a probation officer, there is a growing litany of ex-cons who could have an axe to grind. They begin gathering this information when they're approached by the caretaker of the church in which they've set up their base, and he has an interesting account of the evening's events. According to the caretaker, he and his daughter had seen Christy walking by in the past. On this particular night, they again saw Christy, though they didn't witness the abduction. However, in the moments after her abduction, they did see a vehicle they were unfamiliar with. GBI Special Agent Brian Whidbey later relayed their information, saying, quote, "That person and his daughter saw what they believed to be a white or silver, maybe even a light color SUV, on the road right about the time they saw Christy." End quote. Immediately, police radio out the partial vehicle description so that any of the officers searching can keep their eyes open in case they happen upon one. At this point, the GBI delivers the information to the family, and Douglas Davis is there. The description of the SUV reminds him of an incident which had taken place just 4 days earlier. The previous weekend, there'd been a funeral service for Christy's grandmother, and Douglas had driven up from Atlanta to be there for her. It was a sad day for the family, but Christy was grateful to Douglas for having made the trip. His pastoral influence had brought feelings of comfort to the family. Following the difficult day's activities, Christy told her mother that she and Douglas were going to take a walk. Joanne later said, quote, "Saturday, they went for a walk, like Christy usually did. I assume they went her normal path, and they were gone 30, 45 minutes maybe." End quote. According to Douglas, this was not just another uneventful walk. He told the GBI that, during the walk, a vehicle had approached them on the side of the road. It pulled up quickly, stopping just 3 or 4 feet from them. The vehicle sat there for a moment and then turned back onto the road, speeding off. Douglas told the GBI that it was a light-colored SUV. Authorities began to wonder if this could have been the same SUV, and if so, did this previous incident indicate that this was not random and that Christy was in fact targeted? By 2 a.m., 5 hours have passed since Christy was abducted. The proximity to the North Carolina border concerns authorities that she may have been taken into another state, which would majorly impact their investigation. At this time, they make the choice to pull in many of their officers and agents in order to relaunch a full-scale search of the area when the sun rises. Richard Cornwell, though, is not ready to turn in for the night. In what will become the first example of his complete and utter devotion to finding his sister, he heads out on foot, armed with a flashlight and a handgun, determined to comb every square inch of land along her path. When asked about this later, Richard responded, quote, "There were several scenarios going through my head that night. There was the possibility that the suspect might still be in the area with Christy, so I was prepared for that." End quote. At sunrise on August 12th, Richard is still walking the roadside. He cuts off his flashlight and begins walking through the tall grass in the area that authorities have estimated to be the approximate abduction point. To his surprise, laying there in the weeds, he finds one of Christy's flip-flops. He immediately jumps into the road and flags down a passing deputy. Within minutes, the GBI arrive on the scene with a crime scene investigation truck and begin combing through the overgrown roadside. At the end of their search, they locate the other flip-flop, the earpiece that Christy was wearing at the time, as well as her glasses. This confirms the abduction site for authorities, and the items are bagged as evidence and processed for any possible fingerprints or DNA, which may lead them to a suspect, though they eventually find nothing helpful on the items. The hunt for Christy and her abductor kicks into high gear as the day grows lighter. For the next 2 days, the GBI, working in conjunction with 17 other law enforcement agencies, including local and state, search a 3-mile radius around the abduction point. the FBI sends down a helicopter, which searches from the sky. Dogs are brought in to cover every inch of ground, and dive teams are sent into surrounding rivers and lakes. At its peak, the GBI invests 60 agents to assist with the search and investigation. Sadly, after finding the aforementioned items, law enforcement fails to locate anything else in the area or surrounding wilderness, which points them in any direction. At this point, they believe that Christie was indeed taken in a vehicle and likely driven to another location. Then, a local man makes a discovery that might assist them in mapping a possible direction to head. On August 12th at approximately 5:30 p.m., officers respond to a call from a homeowner located along Notley Dam Road, approximately 3.5 miles north of the abduction site. A man who was mowing his lawn found a cell phone lying in the grass. According to investigators, it seems likely that this phone was thrown from a moving vehicle, likely from the driver's side, and it is later confirmed to be Christie's cell phone. While they have hopes of gaining the abductor's fingerprints or DNA, their hopes are crushed when the man explains that he wiped the phone clean upon discovering it. Hoping that something may still remain, they process the phone, but anything of forensic value has been cleaned away. While this is a blow to the investigation, it does lead them to believe that Christie had been taken north along this road. Unfortunately, following this road further north will eventually lead across the North Carolina state line. Days began passing, and police were finding nothing else to lead them to Christie. By August 18th, 1 week after she was taken, the search area expands to include 3 surrounding counties. Authorities begin canvassing the neighborhoods that had been previously outside of their search quadrant, and ultimately, they visit 400 homes, searching not just for Christie, but also for a light-colored SUV. In addition to the canvassing, multiple roadblocks are arranged in hopes of finding the driver passing back through the area. It's also at this time that the GBI speaks to the family and tries to brace them for the possibility that, at this time, the odds of finding Christie alive are becoming less and less. John Bankhead, a spokesman for the GBI, speaks to the media and states, quote, "In a case like this, time is our enemy. The further away you get from that initial incident, the less chance you have of finding the victim alive." End quote. The family isn't sure what to think. While evidence seems to suggest this may have been a random abduction, the fact that Christie walked the same path around the same time makes them wonder if it's possible that the suspect could have been someone Christie knew, or perhaps someone who had been watching her. In such a small town, it's difficult for them to imagine that one of their own neighbors could be responsible. Joanne states, quote, "I just felt like it might be somebody that knew she walked that time of day. Maybe he had targeted her." End quote. Investigators are considering all options at this time, but when another week passes, they're forced to pull back their investigation. Their budget doesn't allow for a search of that magnitude, involving so many different agencies and covering such a wide swath of area, to continue for that long. 17 days after Christie was taken, on August 28th, many of the officers involved are reassigned to other investigations. For the Cornwell family, it's absolutely devastating. They've remained strong throughout the investigation and the search, and have done everything they can to contribute. Christie is all they think about, day and night. But as each day passes, it becomes harder for the family of Faith to hold on to hope. When authorities begin to pull back from the search, they take it upon themselves to make sure someone is always looking. Flyers are printed up bearing Christie's image, description, and a description of the possible suspect vehicle. They also begin trying to raise funds to assist in the search, as well as to provide a reward. Christie's father, Harold, uses his outdoorsman experience and knowledge of the area to arrange volunteer search parties. Richard flies in his own private Cessna and continues searching from the sky, while donated helicopters are piloted by volunteers. They look over Union, as well as the three surrounding counties, and the family offers a $50,000 reward. The search is continued, but to no avail. Despite the effort and volunteers, Christie could not be located, and no new leads were developed on her possible abductor. They had Christie's items in an evidence locker. They had a vehicle description and a possible direction of travel, but little else. The family spoke to the media in hopes of keeping the story alive, but as is often the case, as the days continued to pass, larger news outlets began moving on to other stories. Authorities continued their investigation, but had little to move forward on. The case essentially fell to a standstill, though the Cornwell family continued using every resource they had to keep Christie's name alive. For them, they believed she was capable of taking care of herself, and they believed she was alive and possibly being held captive elsewhere. Without anything to prove them wrong, they refused to let go of their hope. A month after Christie vanished, on September 11th, campers in the Chattahoochee National Forest came across what appeared to be an improvised campsite. The site was located approximately 10 miles south from the point of abduction, and for a moment, there was consideration given that Christie may have been taken to this location the night she was abducted. For authorities, though, they knew exactly who the campsite was linked to. A year earlier, 24-year-old Meredith Hope Emerson was abducted and murdered by Gary Michael Hilton while walking on a trail on Blood Mountain. On New Year's Day, 2008, Hilton, a drifter, came across Meredith on the trail. According to his statement, he told Meredith he wanted her ATM card and PIN number, but the martial arts-trained young woman wasn't going to give up without a fight. According to GBI director Vernon Keenan, Meredith was, quote, doing everything she could to stay alive. It's not something you can train for. Instinct kicks in. She nearly got the best of him. She's very much a hero. End quote. Hilton later explained that Meredith brandished a knife and was screaming for attention. He ultimately got control of the situation by punching her, breaking his hand, and possibly her nose. He then led her down the trail, where he placed her inside of his van. Meredith remained in Hilton's custody for 4 days, during which time she delayed the inevitable by continually giving him the wrong PIN number. On the fourth day, Hilton led her outside and bound her to a tree. He then casually returned to his van to collect himself and drink coffee. Upon his return, he violently bludgeoned Meredith with the handle of a car jack and, in a sickening addition, decapitated the young woman. GBI agent Clay Bridges later said, quote, "That's the one thing that broke my heart in this case. She was doing everything she was supposed to do to stay alive, and we didn't get there in time." End quote. While the campsite had momentarily sparked interest, it was quickly dismissed, as Hilton was serving a life sentence for the abduction and murder of Meredith, which eliminated him as a possible suspect. In a bizarre twist, Melissa Camp recalled that she and Christie had spoken about that case in the past. For Melissa, it was difficult to reconcile that her best friend may have met a similar fate, though she held on to hope that Christie would be returned safely. The memory of what had happened to Meredith brought in grim possibilities in Christie's own case. With a month now gone, the likelihood that she was still alive seemed to be fading every day. GBI investigators concluded their discussions with all of the ex-cons that Christie had worked with, but no information was gained from any of these individuals. Without anything to connect a possible suspect to Christie, the probability became likely that her abduction had been conducted completely at random. In December of 2009, the GBI called a press conference to announce a probable break in the case. During the press conference, they asked for assistance from the public. They'd been contacted by a female living in Ranger, North Carolina, just 20 miles north of Blairsville, who told them about a frightening incident she'd experienced on August 2nd, just 9 days before Christy was abducted. According to the witness, she had been walking on the side of the road when a vehicle approached at a slow speed and struck her, knocking her to the ground. The vehicle hadn't hit her hard enough to cause major damage, but just enough to disable her. The woman managed to fight off her would-be abductor. She screamed loudly, and a passing vehicle spooked him away. The man got into his vehicle and fled the scene. The most interesting detail? The man had been driving a light-colored SUV. In fact, it was a silver Nissan X-Terra with a black brush guard on the front. This fit the description of the vehicle seen by the church caretaker the night Christy had been abducted. For the GBI, the make and model of the vehicle fitting the description was an important detail, but it was the actions of the suspect that interested them more. The night she vanished, Christy had told Douglas to hang on because she had to get out of the way of a vehicle. Was it possible that the reason she had to get out of the way was because the man was attempting to hit her, as he had the previous woman, in a pretext to her abduction? In what was the most positive news they'd received in a while, the previous victim had gotten such a good look at the suspect that she'd been able to describe him to a sketch artist. A composite drawing was made, showing the left side of the man's face in profile. The suspect was described as being a Caucasian male in his mid to late 20s with dark hair. This sketch was shown at the press conference, and within 24 hours, the GBI received thousands of tips, though none of those tips would pan out. 2 weeks would pass before there would be any movement on this suspect, but then another potential victim called the Union County Sheriff's Department. She told a similar story to the first woman and stated that she clearly recognized the composite drawing. According to this woman, she was on the side of the road dealing with a problem with her car when the suspect approached her from behind and tried to grab her. This victim also managed to fight off her attacker. The woman would go on to say that she got an even better look at the man than the previous woman had, and authorities were able to complete a much more detailed, full-face composite drawing, which was circulated in the area. Authorities now had a good description of a suspect, who they considered a possibility as being the man who abducted Christy, but they had little else to work with. December 20th, 2009, was Christy's 39th birthday. The family marked the occasion by holding a candlelight vigil in hopes of honoring Christy, showing their support, and possibly to gain more attention from someone who may have information. The family made a plea for additional information, and Christy's brother spoke about the reward. In his opinion, they didn't expect to hear from the suspect, but it was likely he had friends, and maybe even a family. Someone who may have information which they didn't even know was useful. The family hoped that they would get tips, but ultimately, nothing came in. For them, the nightmare continued. Where could Christy be, and who could have done such a thing, like abduct a single mother simply out for a walk in a quiet town? It was a question for which they had no answers. 2 weeks later, on January 5th, 2010, the GBI is made aware of two anonymous letters. One was received by the Union County Sheriff's Department, the other by the Cherokee County Sheriff's Department, apparently in reference to the first woman who escaped her attacker. The letters, alleged to have been written by a concerned grandmother, told the tale of a 27-year-old grandson's suspicious behavior around the time of Christy's disappearance. According to a GBI press release, the letters further explain that her grandson drove a white Nissan X-Terra with a black brush guard, and that, on the night that Christy vanished, he did not return home until early the next morning, and when he did, he had scratches on his face, hands, and neck. Her grandson had also been present in western North Carolina around the time the first attempted abduction took place. According to the letter, when she asked her grandson what happened, he said he'd been in a fight. He very quickly left the area and went home to Florida. The letter was postmarked in Charlotte, North Carolina, but there was no other information for them to try and find the writer. There was no return address, and the letter, as well as the envelope, had been written in purple ink. Both letters and envelopes were sent for processing, but there were no fingerprints or forensic evidence present on either. The GBI began looking into white Nissan X-Terras, registered in Florida, but that hit them back with a massive number of possibilities. While they would attempt to narrow down the possibilities, it would be an exceedingly time-consuming task for which they didn't have a large number of agents available. In an attempt to gain assistance of the public and to reach out to the supposed grandmother, the GBI went to Joanne Cornwell with a request. Joanne was asked to reach out to the woman in a public forum, and just 2 days later, they released a video on YouTube. The video runs just over 2 minutes, and I will now play the audio in its entirety.
I'm Joanne Cornwell, Christy Cornwell's mother. Christy was abducted on August 11, 2009 in Union County, Georgia. We don't know where she is. She's been gone almost 6 months now, and I am in a nightmare every day. I'm so worried about, is she okay? Does she have enough food? Is she being abused? Is she cold? And I want to talk to the grandmother that wrote the anonymous letter to the Union County, Georgia and Cherokee County, North Carolina Sheriff's Office, saying that she had suspicions that her grandson may have been involved in Christy's disappearance. We have a lot in common. We have a bond. We both are mothers. We're both grandmothers. And I certainly know how you feel about your grandson. I love my grandson and all of my grandchildren every bit as much as I love my own children. So I know how hard this is for you. Your suspicions are not just a coincidence. There was a time in early August that your grandson was visiting you. And I know you're really concerned. You realize that the sketch of the Ranger North Carolina suspect and the vehicle looked much like what your grandson did and what he drove. It is not for us to prove that your grandson had anything to do with this. That is law enforcement's job. But I know that you are struggling and so concerned for your grandson like I am for Christy. I know it's hard to eat, hard to sleep for you, just like it is for me. Our lives will ever, forevermore be bound with this abduction of Christy. Whether your son, your grandson had anything to do with it or not, you're concerned that he did. And so I just ask for you to come forward and give law enforcement the information they need, and then let them prove or disprove his innocence or guilt. I really feel for you. I pray that you can feel how I feel, and please come forward. We need your help desperately.
Sadly, after the release of the video, no valid tips were received, and in fact, many fraudulent tips were called in. In some instances, disturbing phone calls were placed to the Cornwell residence, upsetting the family. In the following weeks, with nothing new discovered, the GBI were asked whether or not they were giving up on the investigation. John Bankhead assured the press that the GBI was dedicated to solving this case, as they had been from the onset. Agent Brian Whidbey would later say, quote, "We remain realistic. We may not find Christy alive. We hope we do. We hope for her family we do. But based on statistics, it doesn't look good." End quote. At that time, in January of 2010, the case seemed to come to a standstill once again. Despite the efforts of the family and investigators, there simply weren't any new developments. Frustration grew for authorities, and the pain of the family continued to grow, and yet still, they remained hopeful and determined to help Christy. 3 months passed, with little to nothing developing, and then suddenly, a standoff with police in Atlanta led to a new possibility. On April 8, 2010, Atlanta police were involved in an armed standoff with an abduction suspect in downtown Atlanta. They'd received a call to report a suspicious vehicle parked behind the Buckhead Mellow Mushroom restaurant. They found 42-year-old James Scott Carringer was sitting in his black Nissan Xterra with a rifle in his hands. The man had been tracked down after he attempted to abduct a 10-year-old girl from an Easter egg hunt at the Hunter Station Baptist Church in Montgomery days earlier. The entire incident had been captured on surveillance footage and shows Carringer calling over a boy and a girl. He speaks with the two for a moment before shoving the boy to the ground and throwing the girl into the SUV. Luckily, the girl managed to escape from the vehicle before it fled the scene. However, this was not the initial reason that Carringer was being hunted. Days prior to this attempted abduction, Carringer had abducted a 19-year-old woman from a shopping center in the Kennesaw area. The woman was later sexually assaulted, and it was then revealed that the victim was actually a relative of Carringer's, adding another disturbing twist to an already horrendous story. It was during the time that Carringer was fleeing from authorities and going into hiding that he attempted to abduct the 10-year-old from the church. Eventually, they managed to corner Carringer in downtown Atlanta. According to reports of the time, Carringer informed authorities that he was suicidal and that his vehicle was wired with explosives. SWAT officers arrived on the scene, as did the bomb squad. A bomb squad robot was sent towards his vehicle, at which time, authorities heard a single gunshot. Carringer had taken his own life with a rifle that he had with him. The entire standoff lasted 3 hours, and it was later determined that there were no explosives in the vehicle. It was after Carringer's suicide that authorities began making potential connections to Christie's abduction. In the aftermath of his death, police had begun a thorough investigation into him in hopes of linking him to other abductions or attempted abductions in the area. When they arrived at his home, they discovered that Carringer, in addition to his black Xterra, also owned two others, a white one and a silver one. The silver Xterra matched the vehicle described by the first assault victim in Ranger, North Carolina. There was one detail which was off, though. The silver Xterra did not have a black brush guard, it had a silver one. While investigating the area around the Carringer home, authorities located a black brush guard which had been thrown into the woods. According to Carringer's estranged family, he replaced the brush guard himself without explanation. He had also gifted the vehicle to his stepson without any pretense. GBI agent Whidbey stated, quote, "He was driving that vehicle during August of 2009. Just at the end of August, early September, he unexpectedly gave that vehicle to his stepson without discussing it with his current wife. There was no reason behind giving it to his stepson." End quote. This meant, to investigators, that Carringer was driving this vehicle, which matched witness descriptions, around the time Christy vanished and the other attack had taken place. Just 2 weeks after Christy vanished, he had changed the brush guard and given the vehicle to his stepson. In further investigation, authorities uncovered other details which could possibly tie Carringer to the night Christy disappeared. Carringer lived only 18 miles from Christy's parents' home and also had family in southern North Carolina, near the area in which the first victim was attacked. When they questioned family members and friends, most expressed surprise over Carringer's actions, but they also tell the story of a man who would bizarrely disappear for days at a time, during which he was unreachable. They told investigators that Carringer would go on trips, and while on these trips he would turn off his cell phone and wouldn't contact anyone until he was on his way home. Where he went and what he did, they never knew. Carringer did leave a suicide note for his family, though the only piece which has ever been made public is that he acknowledged being sexually assaulted by a neighbor when he was 10 years old. With all of the evidence accumulating, authorities moved to list Carringer as the only person of interest to ever be named in Christie's abduction. Sadly, though, with Carringer dead from a self-inflicted gunshot, they didn't have the ability to question him or gain new information. On the one hand, it was a major break in the case, but on the other, it didn't paint a hopeful picture for Christie's fate. If indeed Carringer had been the one to abduct her, they had no way of knowing where she might be or what he could have done with her. At this point, they began to face the strong possibility that Christie was likely deceased. Despite their statements, the Cornwell family continued to cling to hope. A few weeks later, her brother Richard quit his job to devote himself full-time to searching for his sister. The family sold their lakefront vacation home to pay for airplane and helicopter searches and for the production and mailing of over 80,000 missing person flyers, which were sent all throughout Georgia, North Carolina, and Tennessee. GBI agent Mike Ayers, when asked about the potential connection between Christie and Carringer, stated, quote, "James Scott Carringer is our primary suspect and has been for a long time. I would give anything to have had 30 minutes to talk to him," end quote. It was later revealed that, during the search of Carringer's home, they discovered multiple sets of purple pens, which they believe could be linked to the anonymous letters they'd received from an alleged grandmother. They began to theorize that Carringer may have written the letters himself, either to throw suspicion off, or perhaps in an attempt to get things off his chest. It has never been publicly confirmed that he was the author, though authorities have hinted that this is a good possibility. Over the course of the next 8 months, Richard Cornwell worked in close association with the GBI. They gave him leads, information, and tips on locations that he might search. John Bankhead, when asked about Richard's devotion to finding his sister and his process, stated, quote, "He had a set process where he had to walk every foot of the area he was looking in. He walked every square foot of an area," end quote. GBI agent Mike Ayers, when asked about Richard's dedication, responded, quote, "I've never seen anything like it," end quote. Every time the GBI had a possible location to search, Richard would get there first and cover every inch of it. When asked about his sister, Richard responded, quote, "There's not a day that goes by that we don't think about Christie, and it's constant," end quote. In late 2010, the GBI was able to receive information from James Scott Carringer's cell phone. While he had typically turned it off during his travels, they were able to find a ping. The ping put him in an area near to Christie's abduction site at 11:30 p.m. on the night she vanished. This information was relayed to Richard, who was determined to search for himself. The GBI were planning to canvass the area, but needed time to arrange everything. This gave Richard 2 weeks to search on his own. The cell phone ping led to a 2-square-mile section of land, and Richard began covering all of it. His search was thorough and focused. On New Year's Day, 2011, while so many around the country were recovering from a night of partying and celebration, Richard sadly discovered the remains of his sister Christie. Approximately 75 yards from Moccasin Creek Road, just south of the North Carolina border, Richard discovered the partially burned skeleton concealed beneath leaves. The horrifying discovery was immediately reported to the GBI, who came down to the scene to investigate. For just over a year, They had held out hope that Christy would be returned safely, and sadly, their hopes were dashed in this tragic ending to Christy's life. A medical examiner was not able to determine Christy's cause of death due to deterioration of the body and the burning. However, it was obvious that Christy had been the victim of a homicide, and it seemed most likely that her life had ended within hours of her abduction. It's been stated that authorities found other items of evidence at the scene, though they never revealed what they discovered or where it led them in their investigation. At a press conference, GBI Director Vernon Keenan praised Richard's devotion to his sister, stating, quote, "Richard has been searching diligently for his sister Christy since she disappeared. He has spent many hours scouring the area in Union County, trying to locate her." End quote. When asked for comment, a heartbroken Richard responded, quote, "We're thankful that Christy can now have a proper burial that she deserves." End quote. Joanne was absolutely crushed and choked back tears as she spoke, stating, quote, "We didn't want it to end this way, but that's the way it is. And we can bring her home now. I know in my heart she's in heaven and we'll see her again. So that's what's going to make me be able to go on." End quote. Christy was laid to rest in January of 2011 in a private ceremony held by her family through Cochran Funeral Home in Blairsville. The family asked for donations to be made to your favorite charity in Christy's name in lieu of flowers. Listed amongst those she left behind were her mother and father, Joanne and Harold, her son Brody, her brother Richard and his wife Karen, as well as two nieces, Amelia and Isabella, and a nephew named Connor. The void left in all their hearts can never be filled, but they have taken some comfort in knowing that Christy has been found and given a respectful burial, from which they keep faith that they will once again be reunited with her. But sadly, questions still loom. While authorities still list Carringer as their only person of interest, they have not been able to close the case, as they lack the evidence to, beyond a reasonable doubt, be certain that Carringer was in fact the man who abducted and murdered Christy Cornwell. In terms of theories, this case is very different from many others I've covered. There are essentially two theories in relation to the abduction and murder of Christy Cornwell. The first theory suggests that Christy may have been abducted and murdered by an unknown individual, or perhaps even more than one, and that her murder could have been motivated by something personal, while it may also have been simply a random act of atrocious violence. The second, and most prominent theory, is that Christy was ultimately abducted and murdered by James Scott Carringer. So much of the evidence, though much of it circumstantial, puts Carringer in the area, driving a vehicle of similar description, and it is known that he attempted other abductions following Christie's murder. However, without that final piece to complete the puzzle, there can be nothing known for certain. The abduction and murder of Christy Cornwell is a tremendously heartbreaking case. In so many of these stories, we hear of a victim being taken, and they are never found. The family lives the rest of their lives wondering what happened, wondering if they are alive or dead. In this case, the Cornwell family was able to get the closure that so many others have been denied. But that closure only seals the tiniest of holes in their hearts, left nearly vacant in the absence of their daughter, sister, and aunt. While the Cornwell family may now shut their eyes knowing the truth, their nights will never again be carefree or peaceful. Christy's laughter will never illuminate their homes, nor their smiles. They choose not to remember the way Christy died, but instead the way Christy lived, as a strong, jovial, and vibrant woman who was in the midst of chasing her dreams. In her son, Brody, they see so much of Christy, and in some way, he carries on a piece of her light, and forever will live in the loving world his mother provided for him. Christy Cornwell was a beautiful, bright, single mother with a loving family and a lot of dreams. She worked hard to provide for her son, and while she'd been unlucky in love up until that point, she'd recently met a man with whom she felt comfortable, safe, and even the hope for something more. Her parents and brother are the kind of people who just seem to glow with love and care, the kind of small-town, southern residents who provide support and comfort in times of need. When Christy was abducted, it was they who turned to their friends and neighbors, and it was through them that they found support, care, and people willing to go to great lengths to aid them in their search. The tight-knit community of Blairsville was dealt a heavy blow when Christy was taken, and an even heavier one when her body was recovered. It was a very dark day in their history, but they banded together, rallied around the Cornwells, and did the best they could to lift their hearts. On the funeral home website, there's an entry which holds a small obituary for Christy. That page is absolutely flooded by friends, relatives, and even total strangers, who wish to send out their condolences and to let the family know that they were in their thoughts. While nothing can return Christy to her family, and the pain and grief of her loss can never be truly assuaged, there's a certain level of comfort to be found in the compassion of others, and the knowledge that Christy will never be forgotten and her legacy will live on, through charitable donations, the lives of her family, and specifically, the life of her son, for whom I have a tremendous amount of respect and empathy. This case is a little different from the ones I normally cover. Usually there are several theories, all which have varying degrees of possibility. In Christy's case, for the most part, the family and investigators are united on one theory, which they believe is most likely. This case is, essentially, solved, but due to a lack of evidence and nothing which can be established to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, the files remain open and the case remains officially unsolved. So why did I choose a case this close to being solved? Several reasons, really. First and foremost, I was extremely moved by this case. Every case I cover touches me in some way, but for whatever reason, this one really got to me. As I was reading interviews with the family, statements from the investigators, and speculation about the suspect, I just felt overwhelmed with grief. I didn't know Christy, but through all the research, I began to feel like maybe I did. Another reason was, on several occasions in both emails and through social media, I've been asked if I'd ever cover a solved case. Typically, my answer is no, but I felt compelled to do this one. So frequently we discuss the loss of someone and the pain brought to their loved ones due to a lack of closure. In this case, the family mostly has closure. Christy was recovered, she was laid to rest, and the family was told that the man responsible had died by his own hand. While they may have much of the information they didn't at the time Christy vanished, I don't know that they truly feel satisfaction or closure, as we often speculate they will. Their daughter is gone, and nothing's ever going to fill the void left behind. Beyond that, while they are no longer wondering where she is, they will never know why. A medical examiner couldn't determine a cause of death, and the most probable suspect isn't here to explain his possibly horrendous actions. There are two theories in the abduction and murder of Christy Cornwell. The first theory addresses the possibility that Christy may have been taken, and subsequently murdered, by someone who has never crossed the radar of investigators. While a great deal of evidence exists which points in the direction of one individual, none of that is strong enough to be sure. Much of it is circumstantial, and revolves around his later actions and his location at the time Christy was taken. For many proponents of this theory, they find it difficult to believe that the abduction was merely random. Christy walked around the same approximate time every night, and the probability that someone may have been keeping tabs on her certainly piques their interest when it comes to investigating this tragic and heartbreaking story. Pushing aside all which leads to the suspect I will discuss in the second theory, a full examination of the evidence can certainly leave the door open for other possibilities. Christie's routine certainly could have been monitored, either by someone she knew, or perhaps someone who was simply watching her. We have the account of the church caretaker and his daughter about the night she vanished and the light-colored SUV. Suffice it to say, if these two could notice her nightly ritual while doing their work, it's not improbable to assume that others could as well. While Christie was a kind woman who no one could imagine anyone having a grudge against, she did previously work as a probation officer. And while the information regarding ex-cons she worked with is protected and has never been revealed, many have speculated that she could have come into contact with any number of people who may have wanted to do her harm or hold a grudge. Some have brought up the possibility that, while the prime suspect may indeed be the man who committed this crime, it isn't completely impossible that he could have been urged on to do so by someone else, perhaps someone from Christie's life. This would make that person party to the abduction and murder, and while there's never been anything found to suggest this, there's never been anything found to completely rule it out. And that's the problem in a situation like this one. While authorities believe they have found their man, they can't fully prove it, and that leaves the door open to other realms of speculation. The list, at this point, can be considered quite long. If the abductor and murderer is not the man the GBI believe it is, then it could have been almost anyone. For a long time, Christie's family lived in fear. They wondered how it was possible that someone in their own town could have committed this crime and been undetected. Joanne, Christie's mother, even speculated that someone may have watched her daughter become familiar with her routine and plan the abduction. This is a possibility, again, we can't officially rule out just yet. For the family, they couldn't help but wonder every time they shook a stranger's hand in church or had a conversation at the local supermarket if they could possibly be speaking to the one person who was responsible for their pain. That is for certain a haunting feeling, and one which doesn't easily subside. Of course, this is all speculation. I could go on for hours with possibilities in regard to this case, but for most people who examine it, including the GBI and Christie's own family, they believe her abductor died by suicide in Atlanta. What evidence does exist contradicts the abduction and murder being committed by an unknown figure, but this goes great lengths to show how people will often look for the more complicated answer. When something can't be proven, there's an innate human quality that wants to find the ins and outs, that wants to take what may be a straightforward path and cause the road to curve. A point of contention for supporters of this theory seems to revolve around the composite sketches. In both sketches, we view a younger-looking man with thicker hair. In all the photos I've found of the suspect, he has much thinner, shorter hair. That doesn't make it impossible that there could have been some differences over time, but that would be a rapid change, at least in terms of the thinning. In addition to this, almost every witness described the man as in his mid to late 20s. Carringer was already 40 years old when Christie vanished. Though I understand the interest in stating this contradiction, I've also been very outspoken in past episodes about my lack of faith in composite sketches. In many instances, they kind of just look like everyone. Also, people aren't typically amazing at guessing ages from appearance. I'm often told that I look like I'm in my early 20s when I'm in my mid-30s. Another point of contention is that the case remains open. While they can't officially prove Carringer committed this terrible crime, it wouldn't be the first time law enforcement has closed a case without being able to prove it beyond a doubt. So why is this case still open? The point is, there's room here for speculation. But when it comes to the possibility that Christie was abducted and murdered by someone who has not been named, there's even less evidence to support that. While there are holes in the GBI's case against Carringer, there are chasms in the case against an unknown suspect. The second and final theory is that Christy Cornwell was abducted and murdered by James Scott Carringer, the man who abducted and sexually assaulted a relative, and then, while on the run from that incident, attempted to abduct a 10-year-old girl from a church. Certainly the makings of someone who had the proclivity for committing these kinds of acts, and his later known behavior definitely added to the likelihood, in investigators' minds, that he could have been the man responsible for what happened to Christy. Circumstantial evidence includes several Nissan Xterras fitting the description of the one seen the night Christy was taken, as well as those reported by two other women who were attacked by the driver. Purple pens in his home, which for authorities meant that he may in fact have been the one who authored the letter that was alleged to have been written by a grandmother. Cell phone pings place him in the area near Christie's abduction site within hours of her abduction, and the fact that Carringer had, at a time, lived just 18 miles away from the Cornwell family home. That's an impressive list, which is hard to ignore. In his suicide note, Carringer stated that he'd been sexually assaulted as a child. Whether or not anything else in that letter could assist in trying to pin him in terms of abductions or attempted abductions, we simply don't know. That information has never been released, though I have heard that the GBI has suggested that there was nothing in the note which indicated Christy, her abduction or murder, or anything about Blairsville or that area of Georgia. When Carringer committed suicide, he stole any chance authorities had of gaining information from him. At the time, Christie's remains had still not been located, so even trying to find her was something they couldn't ascertain from him. He took many secrets to his grave, and though we know for certain about the sexual assault perpetrated on a relative, an incredibly heinous act, and his attempted abduction of a child, we know little else. When it comes to Christy, and even the other two women who were nearly victimized, authorities have never been able to establish a link between Carringer and those crimes, other than to say he had been in the area around the time they occurred. As much as we may want to take all that evidence and say it proves guilt, we simply can't. At least not yet. The investigation remains open, and the GBI has said they found items where Christie's remains were located, which were taken into evidence and may assist in the investigation. We don't know what those items were, or why they're being kept hidden if indeed Carringer is the suspect. He's deceased, and knowledge of those items cannot be used to support a defense case. Perhaps there's some other reason. Sensitive nature of the items, it's honestly all speculation. The fact of the matter is, Carringer died in April of 2010. It's been over 8 years, and they've yet to find what they need to conclude with certainty that he was the one responsible for this terrible crime. It's a very difficult case to examine. On the one hand, the emotional side of me wants to believe that James Scott Carringer is the monster responsible for the abduction and murder of Christy Cornwell. The logical side of me wants to follow the evidence, and wants to paint everything in bright shades of black and white. This is one of those instances where, regardless of what you believe, there is a huge gray area which must also be considered. Everything seems to point towards Carringer. All of the evidence which has been found suggests his culpability, and yet it cannot be proven for certain. That's the frustration facing the GBI, the frustration facing the family, and the frustration facing myself and all of you who have listened to this terribly heartbreaking story and stand on the precipice of a conclusion, but you cannot take that final step yet. Given all of the circumstances, it does seem most likely that Carringer is the man who attempted previous abductions and likely abducted and murdered Christy Cornwell. His phone pinged in the area the night she vanished, and Christy's brother Richard found her body in the area where his phone pinged. For me, that's simply too much to overlook, and while I have a respect for those who choose to explore alternative theories, the Carringer theory is the one which carries the most weight with me. From here onward, it's a matter of whether or not new evidence can be found, or something can be brought to the surface which can erase any doubt that may exist. Technological advances are happening every day, and if you need an example of how even the most unlikely to be solved cases can be broken, you need to look no further than the recent developments in the Golden State Killer case. Something like that gives us hope that we may yet find answers to many, if not all, unsolved cases. The abduction and murder of Christy Cornwell is one of those cases that just sticks with you. It's a reminder that, even in our own communities where we've lived all our lives and feel safe, anything can happen. There are vicious, terrible people out there who are looking only to satisfy their own vile interests, and vigilance and awareness are incredibly important. I've been told by a lot of listeners that they walk or jog while listening, and while I'm hugely supportive of this, I always suggest that they carry mace, pepper spray, or some item for self-defense, as well as making sure to turn their volume down as to be aware of their surroundings. Christy was a probation officer. She taught classes in martial arts. She was not an easy victim. Christy's legacy is not in being the victim of a kidnapper or murderer. It's in the eyes of her son, the incredible love and devotion shown by her brother, the hope and faith of her family, and the well wishes and expressions of sorrow from her community. While the answers may not be fully known, and the reason behind this odious action may never come to light, it's important to remember not the hideous monster who committed this crime, but the beautiful light that remains in the wake of Christy's memory, and which still illuminates the hearts of those who loved her, and those whom she touched and impacted throughout her life. If you're interested in finding more information about the abduction and murder of Christy Cornwell, there are many news articles and forums discussing her case. If you have information about the abduction and murder of Christy Cornwell, please contact the Georgia Bureau of Investigation or the FBI. What do you believe happened? Email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com, tweet me at traceevpod, or comment in the Facebook group. Now it's time for me to make some announcements regarding Trace Evidence. Thanks for waiting so long to hear it. The podcast will be celebrating its one-year anniversary on May 22nd. In order to celebrate more fully, I have two events planned. There's currently a contest running in which you can win a pair of Studio Regent headphones, a Trace Evidence t-shirt, and the opportunity to record an outro for a future episode. It's very easy to participate and simply involves sharing your favorite episode, the website, or the YouTube page on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, or all three if you want, as long as you utilize the hashtag TEPODYEAR. That's TEPODYEAR. That hashtag has to be there for your participation to be counted. For more information, visit trace-evidence.com/contest. The contest officially ends at 11:59 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on May 31st and is running currently. I'm also planning to do another Q&A video, so if you have a question you'd like to ask about pretty much anything, visit trace-evidence.com and click on the Q&A link at the top of the page. There you can submit a form of any question you want, and I'll be happy to answer it. For those of you who are not aware, CrimeCon will be held this weekend in Nashville, Tennessee, and I'll be there to represent Trace Evidence. I'll be posting my location on social media and wearing some Trace Evidence gear to stick out. Please feel free to come up and speak to me if you see me so I can give you some stickers, pins, and maybe even take a selfie with you. As a result of my traveling, there will not be a new episode of Trace Evidence released until May 21st, which will be the one-year anniversary episode. I plan to take a short break to reorganize and investigate some future episodes. If you'd like the opportunity to participate in the one-year anniversary episode, I've got a way that you can. You can call in and leave a voicemail to be played on the show. I can't guarantee that I can get every voicemail in, but if I get enough, I'll put them at the end of future episodes as well. Tell me what you think about the show, how long you've been listening, whatever you want. Just make sure you include your name and where you're from. The number to call is area code 770-744-5104. That's 770-744-5104. In another exciting announcement, on October 13th in Atlanta, Georgia, myself, along with the hosts of other podcasts, including Corpus Delecti, Moms and Murder, The Fall Line, Pretend Radio, Targeted, Southern Fried True Crime, Already Gone, Burner Phone, and Pleasing Terrors, will be holding a meetup. The location is yet to be determined, but you will all be updated as we get closer to October. Speaking of other podcasts, on Wednesday, May 9th, Pretend Radio will release a new episode, and if you listen closely, you may just hear a story from a very familiar voice. Thank you all so much for listening to this episode of Trace Evidence. Make sure you enter that contest, say hi if you see me at CrimeCon, and if you can't make it there, get down to Atlanta in October. I'll see you on May 21st for the one-year anniversary episode, and I hope to hear a lot of voicemails from you.